Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Romans chapter 12. We've begun that section where Paul's kind of making some application, kind of talking to them about their Christian lives and how they're going to go about their daily living. We begin in chapter 12 again as we review with the word therefore, meaning he's talked chapters 1 through 11, and now he begins, therefore, this is how you should live. A very important part that I think is in those first two verses, therefore, in chapter 12, verse 1, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, meaning all the things that have come before, the grace he's shown to us and the plan he has for us, to offer yourselves as living sacrifices. Just like lay yourself on the altar, but not as a dead offering, but let God take and use you in this life, holy and pleasing to God. You are acceptable, you are holy, you're pleasing, God's happy with you. This is your spiritual act of worship. To do this, to get in God's grace, let him use you. This is how you worship God. This is your reasonable, if to come to the conclusion, this would be the reasonable thing to do. How do we live as Christians? Come to God and let him use what he's done to you as far as converting you, saving you, getting you into the right standing with God. So how do we do it? Verse 2, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. You're going to have to stop thinking like the world, living like the world, understanding that the world is fallen. The world is under the control of Satan. The world's philosophies are twisted. We've got to redo some things. So do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. That doesn't mean, you know, just make a bunch of rules and things. Where are you going to go? If you're going to leave the world's ways, where are you going to go? You've got to have some direction. Do not conform any longer to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. If you're going to leave the ways of the world, it's going to begin right here by renewing your mind. You're going to have to start thinking a different philosophy. You're going to have different priorities. You're going to have different goals. The ways of the world, again, God created the world. We live in the world, but there's something happening in the world that is bigger than just the world itself. So we're going to get there by renewing our minds. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And so once you've got your minds renewed, and now you're going to have to go about the goal here, this is as practical as you can get, your daily life. You're going to get up in the morning, and you're going to have to start making decisions. I mean, from the minute you wake up, all the way through your day, interacting with your own thoughts, interacting with other people, dealing with other Christians, dealing with world situations, how are you going to make your decisions? And that's what it says right here. So that you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is. Again, and that's talking about every situation. What does God want you to do? Not the way the world thinks, but in understanding things from God's perspective with this renewed mind. What are you going to do? Again, list it. There's a million decisions you make every day with that renewed mind. You're going to be able to test and approve. What would God want to take place in this situation? How would God want me to behave in this? It's not legalism. It's just now being able to think at a higher level with a bigger perspective. Again, we read this. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, and his will is described as his good, his pleasing, and perfect will, and that would be in every situation. And now we begin verses 3 through 8, talking about the spiritual gifts. We've gone through that. The first thing you're going to notice is you've got some spiritual gifts, some talents. Don't think of yourselves more highly than you ought, but begin to use those to benefit other people. And we've over in section, beginning in verse 9, we begin the next section. Paul is going through several sections here as we go through chapter 12 and 13, including soon we're going to get to chapter 13, verse 1, talking about our relationship with government. Government is established by God, but how does the Christian look forward to the kingdom of God, live by a higher standard, but yet function in the government? Well, one, you don't attack the government. The government is there as your servant, and that's going to be explained in chapter 13. But what we're looking at is those verses beginning in chapter 9, going down through verse 21 of chapter 12. As we said before, this is a list, a rapid list of things. They've got imperatives, which means commands in them. The first few are imperative participles. Just kind of, we'll look through them real quickly again. And they're more about how you're going to live as a Christian and how you're going to interact as a believer. Remember, we just finished, if we could in context, we would have just finished verses 3 through 8 talking about spiritual gifts. And now, following the spiritual gifts, he's going to begin to describe love. And the first thing we see is love in our translations. Love must be sincere, or love is sincere. And we talked about that because love could be fake. You could have fake faith. You could have fake wisdom. You could have imitation love, just trying to put on a facade. This is true love. And again, we look at this. I'm going to read through this list, referring to the few things we've talked about. Love must be sincere, meaning it has to be genuine. And it includes hating what is evil. So right away, the definition of love is not just tolerance of everything. Love must be sincere, and that would be to identify what is evil, which is the unraveling of what is good, what God has established as right, what God has established as good. To come and unravel that would be evil. So love would recognize what is the unraveling of God's goodness and hate it. It means abhor it, despise it. You identify it, reject it, have nothing to do with it. It doesn't mean you tolerate it. It doesn't mean, well, you know, everything's acceptable. Because God loves us, everything's acceptable. Absolutely not. Sincere love will identify evil and abhor it. It won't tolerate it. It won't say, well, everything's okay. It means, no, this is wrong. It cannot be loved because it is anti-God. It's anti-God's purpose. Next, it says, cling to what is good. The word cling, it's a marriage term. It means to unite with, stick with. It doesn't just mean to be, you know, associated with it. It means to cling to what is good. And again, good could be seen as just kind of a general, you know, descriptive word of good. But go back to Genesis chapter 1, where God began to create. God saw that it was good. Everything God made was good. So we're going to assume the word good doesn't just mean your description of good or what the media says what is good, but what God says, I created it for this purpose. It's got a good purpose, a good reason it's here. I created it good. You're going to cling to that original purpose. You're going to cling to that original object for what it was designed for. If it be a philosophy, if it be an object, if it be some kind of a concept, you're going to hold to that and cling to it. Rejecting the unraveling of that concept or the unraveling of that purpose, which is evil, you're going to cling to it and continue to live forward with that. The next thing, this is where we began last week, verse 10, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Both the word devoted and brotherly are the words, have the word philo in them, or they mean love. Devoted means family love, like a parent loves a child. And so now we're talking here in verse 10, we're going to be talking about the Christian community, meaning we are a Christian community, and as a family love. It's like you're united in purpose, you're united in goals. We're going through Philippians on Tuesday nights, and we're going to continue to see. The book is about unity. The book is about coming together and the power you've got when you agree on the truth and are not in competition with each other, but you're striving for this very purpose. And this is what this is talking about. Be devoted like a family to one another in brotherly love. Both those are family terms, brotherly love, family love. And that is how you're going to function. Again, this is talking about relationships with the church. We're going to get down into verses like verse 14 talking about interacting with the world. These verses, again, you make your own decisions, make your own applications, but Paul is talking here, especially after coming off of verses 3 through 8, about the spiritual gifts that work within the body as we build the body up, helping each other, advancing the plan of God. He's now talking about how, just like in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14 were about spiritual gifts, chapter 13 was about love, how you function in that spiritual climate. So love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love, like a family commitment. Honor one another above yourselves. Again, that honoring is above yourselves. Instead of promoting yourself, try to advance one another. We used the example last week even of marriage. It's a great way of advancing marriage. If you're married, you're always trying to have the upper hand in the marriage. You're always trying to promote yourself. Use your spouse for your own advantages. Always blame them for what's wrong. That's not going to go somewhere. But if you step back and say, no, I'm in this marriage, I'm going to start advancing my spouse, trying to build them up, advance them. What do they want to do? And if they, in return, do the same thing, you're advancing each other, your relationship begins to grow. This is, again, talking about working with believers. Honor one another above yourselves. In other words, when we interact with each other, we should be trying to promote each other's gifts, each other's causes, each other's needs. We're looking out for each other more than we're trying to use each other. How can I play this person? Again, that's the way the world's going to do it. The world's going to see, how can I manipulate you and use you or network with you to get an advantage? Christian way is, what is your purpose? What is your cause? How can I help you advance? Well, what if they don't help me? Well, the Christian way is, they're looking at you the same way. Well, how can I help you? And so honor one another or build each other up above yourselves. Verse 11, a very interesting verse we looked at last week. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. And so what we've got here is we've got zeal, we've got spirit, and we've got serving. And the purpose is going to be serving the Lord. And you're going to have to keep your well, the word zeal, as you can see right there, where I'm looking at zeal, never be lacking in zeal. And zeal refers to some kind of fire. It refers to some kind of enthusiasm. It means some kind of energy. And you can see you get zeal or energy in the world. You can have a cheering section. You can have some kind of media coverage. You can have some kind of something that keeps, you know, promotion, advertising, to try and keep this thing moving. And we don't want to fall into the trap of keeping our zeal, our momentum in our Christian lives or in your family, your church, as you're working together as a body of believers, by falling into advertising, by falling into the world's ways. We're renewing our minds. We're not going to go the way of the world. We're going to tap into another type of energy. We're going to tap into not advertising, not promotion, not music ceremonies where everybody's fired up with a bunch of cheerleaders. Again, there's a place for all of that because we're part of the world system. This zeal is going to come through the Spirit of God. In other words, your source, and you can see even throughout the Bible, the fire, the zeal, the energy from the day of Pentecost didn't come from a cheerleading praise and worship service, everybody dancing and shouting against those fired up for Jesus. It came from the coming of the Holy Spirit, something real. Not something that we had to create, nothing that we had to use for marketing, but something that the Spirit came in, and you've got a real presence of the God Himself that's driving His plan. It's not a fired up pep assembly. Again, there's nothing. We see David singing, we see David dancing, we see the church gathering together, encouraging each other. There's a place for all that, but don't miss what it's saying here. Your zeal through the Spirit. Why? Because that's how you're going. They're not three separate things. Let's read it again. They could be. It says, never be lacking in zeal or diligence, but keep your spiritual fervor. There's your word right there, fervor, fever, hot. Keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. So how you're going to keep your spiritual fervor, your spiritual fire, your keep yourself diligent. Don't be lacking. Don't be half-hearted. Be centered. Be focused. Because of the Spirit of God is going to provide you that energy. And you're going to serve the Lord and accomplish what you're here to do. Again, this can be replaced with some kind of emotion, some kind of advertising, which will then be not the Spirit of God, but human or man-made. And then you're going to serve the Lord, and now you're not serving the Lord in power, you're not serving the Lord with the Spirit, you're serving the Lord in human works, which if you go to Galatians and you read the description of working in the flesh, it's envy, rage, fits of rage. It's jealousy. It's because this is not Spirit-driven. It's human-driven. It's coming out of the sin nature, manipulating the sin nature to create something that appears to be God's work. It will always backfire. Paul says that because the fruit of the Spirit producing these things, as Paul says in Galatians, is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. These are the things that will produce the things of God. If you go the way of the human, you're going to end up with some kind of a church fight. You're going to have envy, people rivalry. You're not going to be considering others above yourselves. You're going to be trying to use others to get your own advantage, and now you're right back into the world. And so the church has to separate from the world, and how do you do it? You've got to go through a process of renewing the mind. And Paul's right here. Even these verses, verse 9, as we said before, some would consider this first words of chapter 12, verse 9, love must be sincere as possibly a title heading for these next verses. In other words, sincere love. What is sincere love? Well, this is sincere love. If you're going to have sincere love, it's going to look like this. You're going to hate what is evil. You're going to cling to what is good. God's original purpose, God's design, you're going to cling to it like you're married to it. Then you're going to be devoted to each other like a family. You're going to honor one another above yourself. You're going to be more concerned about someone else than you are yourself in achieving God's plan. Well, how are you going to achieve this plan? Well, you're never going to be lacking in zeal. You're never going to be slothful, but you're going to keep your spiritual fervor, your spiritual energy. It's going to come from the Spirit of God, not from human works, and you're going to start serving the Lord. So in other words, you to achieve God's purpose are not going to get yourself fired up and get out and do it. You're going to first be concerned with how can I help you achieve God's plan for you and what are your needs and how am I going to take care of myself? I'm going to stay in the Spirit, following the Spirit, and His energy, His fire will drive me to serve the Lord, which is going to first start with serving you, and everything will continue that way. Again, this is part of sincere love. It's not the fake smile. It's not the fake banner. It's not some kind of Christian community that we're all going to pretend we're Christians. It's got to be genuine, and we're going to get there. There's going to be a separation process coming. Looking in verse 14, it says, "Bless those who persecute you." Now, we're not there yet, but understand, this energy, this love has to be able to endure more than the year 2017 in West Des Moines at this time, where everything is kind of all together, everybody's working together. It's going to have to endure persecution. It's going to have to endure people being driven apart by all kinds of problems. And that church, like we said before, Paul is writing this letter. He's writing this letter in 57. I know I've said this before, but I don't want to lose sight of this. If you want application for today, this is where it's going. This is 57 AD. He's writing from Corinth to Rome. Paul, and again, it's peaceful in Rome. Paul will end up in prison in 62. Well, he'll end up in 60 to 62 AD. He'll be in prison in Rome. Let's say he gets out in 62 AD. And they actually hear his trial. Nero hears Paul's trial, dismisses it. So he had a chance to kill, arrest, keep in prison, one of the leading Christians, apostles of all time. And Nero heard his case, dismissed it. That's what's going on in the book of Philippians. But in 64 AD, massive persecution begins to break out in Rome because Rome burnt. The persecution sets in. Apparently, if you put the history together, no one knows exactly for sure how it all took place, but Rome burns. What started the fire? It's questionable. There's Tacitus and different historians record and discuss it. But it kind of comes down to this, that Nero possibly started the fire or ordered the fire to burn Rome or at least use the fire to help rebuild Rome in his own image, call it Neropolis or something. But when the public didn't like it, when they didn't want to build the wall or whatever, they blamed Nero. And Nero says, it's not my fault, but blamed the Christians, says they started it. Now, that's not a hot shot at Trump. I'm just using that as an example. They blamed the Christians, and so what Nero didn't get, he lost political favor, if he ever had any, and blamed the Christians. And so by 64 AD, Nero is killing Christians. So in 57 AD, Paul's writing this, count the years, we're 7 years away from one of the most hideous persecutions in Rome, or one of the first major persecutions. This is what people always talk about, people being fed to the animals, and it happens throughout church history at different times. But we're 7 years away. When Paul's released from prison, he's maybe 24 to 30 months away. He's released from prison, and within 2 years, Christians are being executed and burned at the stake, fed to animals, because they are Christians. My point is, once again, do you see how fast it changed? Paul's writing in 57 AD, work together. You've got to keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. It can't be a pep rally. It can't be emotions. It can't be human works. You can't be networking with each other, trying to use each other for your own advantage. You've got to be honoring each other, serving each other. Your love has to be genuine. You've got to hate evil. You at least have to be able to recognize what is evil and then hate it and then cling to what is good. And if you can't do that in a time of peace, if you can't have sincere love, you can't identify evil, if you can't cling to what is good, if you can't do that while it's peaceful, listen, there's problems coming to this Roman church. Paul's talking to him in 57 AD. He'll be there and released from prison in 62 AD. And then within 24 months, this whole culture changes. They're now in hiding. They kill. Peter is killed. Peter is arrested because he ends up in Rome. By that time, he's finally in Rome. He's arrested and killed by Nero. Nero lets Paul go free in 62 AD. 24 months later, he executes Peter. Now understand my point. That is how fast the world changed for the Romans. We are in a situation with mass media, with the internet, with the interlocking of cultures, and things move a lot faster. And if you're at peace right now, there is possibility that things could switch. This is not me prophesying or trying to be negative, but just saying we need to take these things serious. We need to be more than just hearing Bible verses and pretending we're Christians or pretending we've got love. We need to be able to put these things into practice, because look in verse 14, Paul then says, "Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn, live in harmony with one another, do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited." Verse 17 again begins, "Do not repay anyone evil for evil." You got to be able to identify what is evil, but you don't use evil to combat evil. You say that's evil, but you still have to bless the people that are involved in it. In other words, bless. When we get into talk about blessing, that blessing is the focus of this blessing is probably going to be prayer. Not blessing them, they have a good life, may they have their best life now. It's probably going to be, while they're persecuting you, you're praying for their eyes to be open. They're praying, it was Wycliffe, right? John Huss, Wycliffe, burned at the stake. Who's the guy that burned at the stake? I just forgot his name. John Wycliffe burned at the stake, and they took his Bible. No, it wasn't Wycliffe. Tyndale, thank you. William Tyndale in England was burnt at the stake for translating the Bible into English, and his last words on the stake as he is burning was, "Father, Lord, open the king's eyes." Now, I mean, would you be able to pray that the king is having you burnt because you translated the Bible from Latin into, or from Greek in this case, into an English translation? And he doesn't want anything to do with it because he started his own church. Now he's separated from the Church of Rome, and he's got his own church, Church of England. And he wants to maintain control, but your English translation is causing trouble for him. So he has you burnt at the stake. And your final prayer is, open the eyes of the king, or the king of England. I mean, could you pray that? I mean, that's what he's saying. When he's talking about pray for those who are bless those who persecute you, you're praying for their eyes to be open, for their hearts to be softened to receive the truth, to be willing to reconsider Christianity as a true religion, the true God, a real philosophy that matches reality. And when I say philosophy, I mean philosophy that matches the reality of the world we live in. A false philosophy is a philosophy that doesn't match reality. This is what's real, but your philosophy is like whacked out. It's like it doesn't even match. Well, this is what we believe. This is going to destroy you. Christianity contains a philosophy, a worldview that matches the reality because it's the creation, the creation of the Creator. William Tyndale prayed that the eyes of the king would be open. What's interesting, we'll talk about this tomorrow night, is when he prayed that prayer, within a few months, the king realizes we need a Bible for our people. Does anybody have a good translation? They go, here's one. And they actually take the Bible that William Tyndale translated and begin to mass produce it by government expense and hand it out to the churches. I mean, that's crazy stuff. The king burns William Tyndale, and then within a few months says, you know, we need an English translation. They said, where did this one come from? Oh, you remember that guy you burnt 2 months ago or 2 years ago? It's his. Well, this will be great. This is perfect. It's like, what are you thinking? Well, that's part of blessing those who persecute you. That's part of praying for those who are coming against you. Is our method is to, listen, we abhor evil. We identify evil and separate from it. We do not tolerate evil. But evil is separated from the people that are involved in it. That's a little bit of thought to put that in perspective. Because Paul says several places, we do not wage war against flesh and blood. We're at war with evil. We're at war with what is deconstructing God's goodness. And just because people have been sucked into that and are being used as tools in that warfare doesn't mean that's the easy target. That's the carnal way of fighting. Those people, we're against those people. No, you're against evil. You identify evil. What is evil? It's the deconstruction of what is good. It's the rewriting of what God had planned. It's the opposite of God's intention. It's trying to recreate reality. It's Satan recreating God's reality into his own false philosophy. It's going to suck people in. You have to identify what is evil, but yet those people that are involved in it, promoting it, I guess, consider them victims. I don't want to go liberal on you, but it's like, Jesus Christ came to the earth to save us good people and then punish the bad people. You understand? That's not the Bible message. Jesus didn't come to the earth to save the good people. He came to the earth. Romans even says that while we were yet his enemies, we were those people. We were sucked into evil, even if it's just merely the sin nature and going downhill from there. Jesus came to bring us out of darkness into light. Now, what's the difference between us, believers, and those people who are wrapped up in evil? Nothing, except for the fact that we've seen the light. We've been brought over into the truth through Jesus Christ because He went to get us and brought us here. So, when we face persecution, it's going to say, we need to bless those who persecute us. Pray for them. Ask that their hearts would be softened. Give them a chance. And what's going to come out of this is that love that we share as believers, that love extends beyond the boundaries of the church to the world. Not accepting evil. This is the tough part. Because you still have to identify evil. Now listen. We're supposed to hate what is evil. It says abhor evil. Just as soon as it says love must be sincere, hate evil. If we say, well, love means not to mention evil, not to identify this. Everything's fine. Everything's okay. Well, now what you've actually started doing is you've hidden the truth, you've changed the truth, and you're accepting people in evil for evil and saying, it's okay. That's not love. That you've now, you no longer have sincere love. You've got fake love. You've got modern American tolerance love. We just put up with everything. That's destructive. That's going to come back and bite you. That's going to end up destroying you, your God's plan for you, your culture. You have to love, must be sincere, and that love must be able to identify evil, hate the evil that you've identified, abhor it, and evil, again, is the deconstruction of what God called as good. But what about these people that are over here? When they start applying evil, persecuting you, these people, you're from this position of love, you're supposed to bless these people. That means pray for them, that their eyes might be open, they can see, this is stupid, this is evil, this is destroying you, this is the deconstruction of reality to create a false, this is Satan. You hate evil, you hate Satan, but when the people are caught up in this, they're going to persecute you, and if you just accept this, you understand how wicked it is to just tolerate this? And say, we're all the same. It's all. There's no good, there's no bad. Everyone's fine. God loves everybody. God loves everybody. He wants to bring everybody into the truth. But at the end, if you're still sided over here, I'm not going to bring judgment. The church isn't going to have a council and bring judgment. God is going to bring judgment on evil, on Satan, and all those who remain aligned with it. So our job is to, just like Jesus did for us, bring us out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. And so these last verses, and we're not even talking about them today, but that those last verses beginning in verse 14, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. And then it goes on into verse 17, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. Meaning you're going to have to, we'll talk about that. If it is possible, meaning it may not be, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. As far as it depends on you, whatever you can do with the people in the church, with the people in the world, live it, get along with them, as far as it depends on you. Now, there's eventually going to come a time where you're going to have to say, I can't go there with you. If you can meet them at the grocery store and buy coffee with them, if you can go to school with them, there's some of these things, yeah, get along with them. But when they come over here and they want you to join them, not at Starbucks, not at school, not, you know, somewhere with family reunions or something. They want you to join them in evil. Can't go there. I can go to Starbucks, even if they got bad cups. I can go to school. I can go to the family reunion. But you want me to come over here? Now I can't. Now you may get persecuted. But I can't come over here because this is evil. So, again, Paul's not saying he's not a Muslim. It's like, kill the infidel. No, love the infidel. Just like Christ loved you, you were an infidel and brought you in, letting you see the truth and accept the truth. Do whatever you can to draw them in. There's not even any comparison between Christianity and Islam. That's that whole concept. And it's ignorance steeped on it promoting evil. But anyway, that, I don't want to go off on that. Here we go. Let's go back to our text. Remember those years? Because when this switches, if this switches, and the Bible says it throughout history, it always has. There's always the pendulum. We may be in a position in our culture, we've talked about it, where in just a matter of moments, a few days, an election, an assassination, things can just flip around. I mean, everything could flip in a matter of days where Christianity is now persecuted, just like Nero was persecuting it. And now these verses are not just Sunday school verses. They're not just something we study in church. It's like, can you really hate evil while you cling to good? Be devoted to each other like a family, not just get together and drink coffee together at church. I mean, like, protect each other's backs because everyone else is trying to get you. Never be lacking in zeal, meaning become discouraged and quit, because all you were running on was a pep rally at church every Sunday, and now you're going to have to tap into something. There's no pep rally. There's just persecution. There's just people coming after you, trying to stamp out Christianity. Can you tap into the Spirit and still have that fire to serve the Lord? Or is that just a Sunday morning pep rally thing you had going? And then it says, verse 12, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, and faithful in prayer. And we ended the week, I'm still reviewing. Isn't that sad? Isn't that pathetic? I'm so sorry. Because I want to get to these verses, verse 14 and 15. But here we have, be joyful in hope, be patient in affliction, and then be faithful in prayer. And right there are possibly the three areas of your Christian life. Hope. You live your day in hope, knowing the future is better. You live your life in hope, knowing that death has been conquered by Jesus Christ. You live your life in hope, knowing no matter what happens today, God has taken us to another place. We're going to serve Him today, but this is not it. This is not the end of the ball game. This is we're in the game. We win in the end. You're living in hope. But today, you're going to face affliction at whatever it is. Maybe you're not being persecuted, but like we said last week, you are growing old. Well, that's particularly on my mind now as I get older. It's like old age birthdays then used to be like a sign of affliction. They used to be like days of celebration. Now it's like, how old? Oh, my gosh. And you just keep, you know what I'm talking about, possibly. If you don't, you'll know. But it can be just the fact that you're here on earth aging. Or it can be some kind of persecution, if it be social persecution. Or it could manifest eventually in some kind of actual physical persecution. In this world, we've got to have hope for the future. But we're going to be living in an age of affliction where this is not where you're having your best life now. And how are you going to make it through this age where you're living in hope for tomorrow in an age of affliction? You're going to have to be faithful in prayer. You're going to have to continue to come to God and pray. Ask for strength. Ask for advice. Ask for direction. Ask for strength to get through this. So this is what he's saying right here. And this is where we ended last week. Your Christian life can almost be summed up by this. Be joyful in hope. Find your joy in your future hope. Then, in affliction, the word is patient in the NIV here. It's from the word hupomone. I mean, be patient. Find satisfaction. Find joy in the fact that you are able to endure this. It's the ability to endure beyond what everybody else can endure because you understand it's passing. This affliction you're facing today is not the end. You're going somewhere. And how are you going to make it through this? And it says right here, be faithful in prayer. Now, new material, verse 13. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. So sharing with God's people who are in need. And we're going to look at these words right here. That first word, share, comes from a Greek word, koinonia. It means fellowship. And a lot of times we talk about fellowship. Again, I've been in churches where they had the fellowship hall. You know, this is where we have fellowship. Not bad, not wrong. But that's when we get together and we fellowship. We have a meal. We, you know, the early church did that. But this fellowship is not necessarily fellowshipping with each other. Read this again. I'll go through the notes here in just a moment. Share with God's people who are in need. And the word share is koinonia. With God's people, that means now we're talking about people in the church who are in need. And this need, we can see on the list of the notes there, and I'll refer to it in a moment. Need is in the examples of the Bible that are given. This always refers to material needs. This refers to something that they're lacking in their physical life. And the koinonia is not so much koinonia with the person, but koinonia, fellowship with these needs. In other words, when you see a believer with needs, physical needs, you're going to join with the need. And in other words, you're going to bring your provisions over to the need and solve the need. Let's look at the notes, please, if you don't mind. Now again, this is coming under that category that could have been headed as genuine love. Genuine love could be this right here. Verse 13. Number one, this basically says practicing concern for one another. In other words, as the body, again, we'll talk about people outside the church. We just kind of introduced a little bit of it. But right now we're talking about those within the church. Now, this does not mean you wouldn't show concern for someone outside the church. That would be part of blessing them. But this is talking, again, about in the church. When you see a brother in need, you're going to come together. Contributing is the word koinonotos, which comes from the familiar Greek word koinonia. And again, I refer to on page 6 that you've got page 6, right, from today. And you can see above it, you can see in this the little box I've got there of the Greek translation. The middle line is the Greek lettering. Right above the Greek lettering is the same Greek word, but transliterated into English letters. Then right above that is, again, the Strong's letter. Below it first is going to be the English translation used here. And then underneath that is the part of speech it's being given. And again, point A under 2 is the idea here is not to fellowship with the believer themselves, but to fellowship with their need. The word needs always refers to material needs, and I've got a list of all these verses right here that actually refer to the physical needs of believers. So if it's being Acts, Titus, Ephesians, Philippians, it's always talking, even Paul talks about his own needs. You've been concerned about my needs, I mean his rent payment for his apartment in Rome, or his needs for whatever he has. Not emotional needs necessarily, but the physical needs of the believer. Hospitality. Now we move on down. The next one says two things in the Greek. You see the two words in the Greek, hospitality and practicing. Just two words, practicing hospitality. But the word practicing, if you look at that word right above it, which is the word you can see at the bottom of page 6, I've got it written out there for you, D-I-O-K-O, D-I-O-K-O, or Delta, Iota, Omicron, Kappa, Omicron, Dioka, it is the word which already has been used and will be used again in these verses. It is the word pursue, which is translated before and after in different verses. You can see it in your text. Is translated as the word persecute. So in a positive sense, pursue means, as you see right here, practice. Or, to put it in more specific terms, go after hospitality. Go after. Don't just practice in a sense of, oh, someone's here, come on in. It's like go out and find an opportunity, just like someone's out persecuting Christians. You don't. When you're persecuting Christians, you don't just sit at home and watch TV, and if someone knocks on the door, hi, I'm a Christian. Oh, come on in. Let me persecute you. If you're actually persecuting, well, look at Paul. When he went to persecute Christians, what did he do? He went house to house. He didn't sit at home and wait for them to come to his door. He went out and found them to persecute them. And that's what the same word. Now, if you're going to persecute, use this pursuing Christians. In fact, we could translate before, when they pursue you, bless them. They're apparently pursuing you to hurt you, to harm you. So if they're pursuing you in a negative sense, it's persecution. But here, you're pursuing hospitality. You're not persecuting hospitality, but you're going out and you're pursuing an opportunity to be hospitable. You're looking for a way. It is listed as it's interesting here, I'll point this out as we go by. There's many fruits of the Spirit or characteristics or gifts of the Spirit that everyone, in a sense, should have. You should all have be merciful. You know, you should all be hospitable. You should all be giving and supporting Christian work somehow. There's these lists. But then we go through the list of spiritual gifts. Some are recognized as having the gift of mercy, which seems as if they're going to be able to step it up high. Teaching. We should all be able to teach and explain things from the Scriptures to your children, to your spouse, to your friends. But some people are teachers. They teach, but they take it to another level. Mercy, they take it to another level. notice this right here. Hospitality is going to be, in 1 Peter, we see hospitality. Here, everyone should be hospitable. But Peter's going to list it as a gift. Some have this gift of hospitality. I mean, it's not necessarily the gift of teaching. It's not necessarily the gift of giving. It's the gift of hospitality. Now, we all should be teaching. We all should be merciful. We all should be honoring or be hospitable. We all should be giving. But some people have these gifts that take this to more of a supernatural level. Anyway, what we see right here, after it tells us, always be contributing or pursuing the needs of others, is be hospitable. And what this, you see the word hospitable in point 3 at the bottom of page 6. Hospitality is a Greek word, philoxenos, which means love for strangers. Now, do you see that philo? There's your Greek word, love. And then xenos for stranger. Just like we saw before, that family term of Philadelphia or love, brotherly love, honoring each other. This now is a love of strangers. So have a love of strangers, literally means love of strangers, is referring to providing food and shelter to traveling visitors. This most likely is in reference to traveling Christian teachers and missionaries. Now, we know this, and again, be careful as I go through this. I don't want to become too specific and miss the point of this, but we are talking about being hospitable. First of all, it talks about needs. And we're talking here about Christians' needs, people that have physical needs within the church, fellowship with them. Go join with those needs and solve that problem. We're talking about in the church. So we're talking about physical, material needs in the church. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned about others outside the church. That's just what Paul is addressing. Now he comes over here and he says, hospitable, pursue hospitality. Hospitality. I'll scribble some words there. Okay, or letters there. Okay. In pursuing hospitality. Now, is this inviting people into your home? Yes, it can be. But in the context of this New Testament church, there were people that were traveling. These are maybe people in your community, that in your local church that have needs. These are going to be strangers. So they're not, the whole very word means the love of strangers. It's not something that you sit together in church or you fellowship with every week or something, or lives in your neighborhood. It's a stranger who's coming by. In these days, we talk in the Christmas story, there's no room in the inn. That's, of course, a kind of a special little verse. You know, the special inn was busy. And you think Holiday Inn, you think so. The inns were places where travelers stayed, and they were not necessarily safe places. It may have been a good thing there was no room in the inn for Joseph and Mary, and that they could find the safety of a barn, okay? I mean, the inns were not as there were travelers, robbers, thieves. It was not necessarily a safe place to be. So, hospitality is dealing with people that are coming into your community. Now, does this mean the Christian should have, you know, an open door policy that just come on in and stay at our house? It can. But in the context here, we're talking about the church, inside the church. And what we're going to see very clearly is we're going to have traveling apostles. And if you think about it, just let me to build this here, teachers, missionaries. And if you look at the early church, the hospitality of the house church, where the church would meet, or people that were involved in the church, when a traveling minister came by, they didn't have, like, seminaries where people would graduate, they'd go off and they'd have church plants, they'd send someone there and they'd start a church. They didn't have it was a pagan culture. They were going from Jerusalem into Asia, into Italy, into Europe, and they're going into pagan territory. Sometimes there was a Jewish synagogue there. That was nice because it kind of laid some foundation. But they'd go into just pagan cultures. And so when someone would come as an apostle or they're going to come as a teacher to kind of give further instruction to the church, they're just going to houses. There was no, in a sense, a network. There was no institution. The church was just Christians living in homes, meeting together. And when someone would come, they would have to be welcomed into the house. And this is how the early church... Well, look at Paul's ministry. He stayed in houses. He visited places. Like we see him go to Philippi. He went into someone's house and they started the church there. He would stay different. In Rome, he's renting an apartment. That's interesting. But this hospitality was for these traveling teachers that were going from place to place. And I've got on the list right here, you can see these verses. We could go through and look at all of these. You've got 1 Timothy 3:2, Titus 1:8, Hebrews 3:12, 1 Peter 4:9, where people are coming and they'd be staying. You'd be welcoming people in that had the gospel message. And you look down at the bottom of page 6, Matthew chapter 10, verse 11, Jesus told his disciples to rely on this. In other words, he says, when you go, just don't take it. When he first talked to them, he sent them out, just go, and if they welcome you, bring your blessing, greet them. If not, shake the dust off and go to the next place. Someone will welcome you. And that hospitality was for these traveling advancers of the Christian faith. It'd be apostles or teachers or missionaries. They're to be welcomed in. Now, we're going somewhere with this. Stay with me. Turn to page 7. The church in the house, we can see in chapter 16 of Romans. I'm going to look there, chapter 16, verse 23. Because again, there were no church buildings. And chapter 16, verse 23, I'm reading this. Gaius, whose hospitality I and the whole church here enjoy, sends you his greetings. So Gaius is in Corinth. And we've met him when we go back in Acts. We meet him in the book of Acts. He's addressed in, or spoken of in the first letter to the Corinthians, where now Paul is closing down the letter to the Romans, and he says, Gaius, whose hospitality I and the whole church here enjoy, sends you his greetings. So Paul apparently is writing the letter to the Romans from whose house? He's got a place there. He's got a room. It's probably a large house. It's probably a wealthy guy. We know that. And the whole church meets in the guy's house. So they're welcomed, if it be weekly or a couple times a week, they're welcomed into his house for fellowship. But Paul himself, as an apostle, has been welcomed into Gaius' house. And Gaius is providing for him, not hoping he pays for something, but he's providing for Paul so that Paul can do his work. Now, again, we know that Paul's working at different places and takes care of himself. But here, Gaius is showing hospitality. Another verse we see right here, go to chapter 16, verse 5. Same chapter. Greet also the church that meets at their house. And he's referring to in verse 3 and 4, where he's saying, say hello to Aquila and Priscilla. Now, it's again, if you're into the Bible history here, it's kind of interesting. Because Paul first meets Aquila and Priscilla while he's in Corinth. Because they'd been kicked out of Rome because they're Jews. They'd been expelled. So he meets them in Corinth. But by the time he gets around to 57, writing to the Romans, Priscilla and Aquila are, where are they at again? They're back in Rome. So we see Aquila and Priscilla, if you stay with me, we see them in Corinth with a business and a house. If you read other places, you also see them in Ephesus with the church meeting in their house. So when you think cash, when you think about someone you want on your church board contributing to the church, you're thinking Aquila and Priscilla. They've got a house in Corinth. They've got a house in Ephesus where the church meets. And now when Paul writes to the Romans, they've left, they've been in Corinth, they were in Rome, got kicked out, they went to Corinth, started a business, hired Paul, had a house where the church met. Then they went over with Apollos and were in Ephesus where they've got a church and the church is meeting in their house. But by the time 57 rolls around, they're back in Rome with the church meeting in their house. Now, they're not living in a trailer. They're moving it around. They've got houses in three major European cities. So again, it's kind of an interesting fact right there. And so he says, say hello to Aquila and Priscilla and the church, in verse 5, the church that meets in their house. So clearly, Aquila and Priscilla, I would say, were practicing hospitality, but maybe you could step it up and say they've got, like Peter talks about, the gift of hospitality. They've got the gift of having a church meet in their house, and they're moving people in and out, welcoming these apostles, the teachers, the missionaries, if it be in Corinth, if it be in Ephesus, if it be in Rome, wherever they're at, that's part of their place in the body of Christ, is to just support and filter people through so they can bring the gifts in, support the gifts while they're, and send the gifts on their way. Now, we're going to go to 2 John and 3 John. Go to 3 John first. And this is, again, I hope you find this interesting. I'm trying to explain what this hospitality means. It doesn't mean, it can mean, you know, take people out to eat, have people over for lunch after church, you know, bring cookies to church, whatever it means. But in this text right here, we're talking about in the church, the physical needs, make sure you meet the needs, fellowship with the needs of other believers, but also be hospitable to strangers. And again, strangers are not going to be people in your community. They wouldn't be a stranger. Potentially, if I push the meaning of the word. But go to 3 John. Now we're jumping to 85 AD. We're jumping later. We're, you know, some would say the second generation of the church. We're in 85 AD now. Peter's dead. Paul's dead. All the apostles are dead except John, who's still alive. He was there in the beginning with Jesus. He was there at the baptism. He was there in the ministry. He was there at the transfiguration. He was there at the crucifixion. He was there at the resurrection. He was there at the start of the church. John was there in Jerusalem during all the early events. In fact, his brother was killed right away at the beginning. James was killed right away. John was there. And now in 85 AD, John has gone up into Asia, probably living around Ephesus. He's an old man. We'll say 85 years old, potentially. Again, that's an estimate. But yet he's still functioning. He's still teaching. He's maybe not traveling as much. That's an assumption I'm making. But he is training up students. He's not just letting the thing fade away. He's got an army of students that are taking his place. Papias, Polycarp, Ignatius knew him. We find that from church history. And there were many, many others. Now, he's probably got, again, I'm making some assumptions here that matches. He's probably speaks in churches, you know, in his area. He's going to be in Ephesus, and Timothy was the pastor there for a while. If you can imagine kind of being the head of the church of Ephesus, meeting Aquila Priscilla's old house, or maybe while they're there. And then all of a sudden, John shows up and sits somewhere in the congregation. It'd be like, oh my gosh, John, when you want to speak? No, I'm here just to visit. It's like, oh, well, let's just sing songs today. It's like, how would you feel with John the apostle? Well, anyway, so I'm not sure exactly what his function is, but he is teaching and training people. I don't want to use the word school, but that would be a good kind of picture of what he's got, where he's preparing people. Now, in John, 3rd John, in 2nd John, he's writing to the church, and he's got a couple problems in both letters that he's addressing. I'm going to read 3rd John to you, which sounds ridiculous, but it's not that long. The elder, that's what he identifies himself as, the elder. To my dear friend Gaius, again, this is not the same Gaius from Corinth, it's another Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you. Now remember, we talk about Philippians, we're going through the beginning of a letter. This is typical starting of a letter. Even as your soul is getting along well, it gave me great joy to have some brothers come and tell me about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. Now Gaius is in a city. He's probably got a house church, or at least he's a member of a church, and he's stable. Not stable, he's stable, but he's like permanent. He's living in a city. And the brothers come and tell about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. The brothers would be these guys. This right here. Probably not apostles, because that's John, but he's trained teachers and missionaries, we'll say, evangelists if you want to. The brothers, they've gone out, they've traveled, they've received hospitality, and they come back, and John says, okay, give me a report. How are my churches doing? He's 85, I spent my life promoting the gospel. How's this guy? Just like Paul, when Paul closes down Romans, he's got a huge list of names. He knows everybody all over from Rome to Ephesus, and they're all saying hi to each other. They know each other. So these brothers come back to John. He says, how's everything going? They say, Gaius is still walking in the truth. He's committed. Now, watch this. Verse 4, very nice verse. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children, meaning the believers that have learned from him that he's helping guide, are walking in the truth. He says, that's what I wanted to hear, that you haven't given up the faith. Verse 5, now begins another section. Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing for the brothers. The brothers are not just general people. The brothers are the traveling ministers that John has trained and sent out. Even though they are strangers to you. See, there's the word strangers. They have told the church about your love. Wherever John's at, they've come back and reported to John's local church what Gaius is doing. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. Again, that's what they would do. They'd receive them, provide for them while they were there. And if you get into the Didache, the writings of the apostles, it's an early, late 1st century, early 2nd century book, they would stay for 2, maybe 3 days, and then you'd send them on their way with food for 1 day, and they'd go somewhere else, going from church to church to church, if indeed you were. Again, there's all kinds of rules for this that's going to develop for the traveling ministries. He says, in other words, send them on their way. Then it says, man are worthy of God. Verse 7, it was for the sake of the name, meaning Jesus and what he represents, that they went out. receiving no help from the pagans, meaning there are no tax exemptions for them, we ought therefore to show hospitality to such men so that we may work together for the truth. In other words, this hospitality is an intricate part of the working of the early church as people are traveling and spreading the gospel. And as it continues to spread out, there's got to be people that are setting up house churches and places of hospitality to keep these people moving. Verse 9, I wrote to the church that Gaius is a part of. Now, this is an interesting part. But Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. There it is. He's not considering others above him. This would be an example of a man who has not got genuine love. He's not hating what is evil and clinging to what is good, honoring others above himself. He loves to be first. He says, Paul says, or John says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. He just threw our letter away. So if I come, Paul or John is still traveling, I will call attention to what he is doing, gossiping maliciously about us. In other words, when I come to your city, I'll bring attention to Diotrephes and rip him to shreds in front of everybody. Because he's not living honorably. He's not considering others above himself. He wants to be first. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. So now you've got a church somewhere that Diotrephes has taken over, and when the brothers show up, the teachers, the missionaries that John has trained and sent out, because he can't be everywhere at once, Diotrephes says, no, we don't need you here. I've got this. He won't let the brothers come in because he wants to be first, and he's actually now in a church, not practicing hospitality, putting himself first. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church. In other words, if someone says, well, Diotrephes, these guys are from John. Let them come in. He says, you're going to give me static? Then I'm going to kick you out of here. He's starting to excommunicate people from the church. We're in 85 AD, and there's someone that's taken over a church and is excommunicating people. Says, you can't join us anymore because you don't listen to me. Now, listen, it's one thing to say, you know, I don't agree with Galen. I think Galen's wrong. I encourage that. He said, I don't necessarily think Galen's right. That's one thing. That's even not on the radar. God's not even concerned. But to put John and say, I don't agree with John. Or John's teachers that are being sent out and say, yeah, we don't need them here. I've got this. I think you're in some pretty dangerous territory. But anyway, he's not being hospitable. He's definitely of the world. Verse 11, dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. In other words, right there, don't pay evil for evil. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone, and even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, and you know that our testimony is true. I have much more to write to you, but I do not want to do so with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, face to face. And in other words, his whole issue there was Diotrephes. We've got a problem. Go back to, for the sake of time, we got to hurry. Go back to 2 John. And now we're talking about the same thing, verse 1, the elder, that's John, to the chosen lady, that's the church he's writing to, and her children. Verse 4, it has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth. Notice he says some of your children. Just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I'm not writing you a new command, but one that we've had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. Again, genuine love, not that passive tolerance that we just talked about. Genuine love. Abhorring evil, clinging to good. I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. Love is walking in obedience to the teaching of God's truth, not walking in tolerance and not offending anybody. As you've heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Now, verse 7. Many deceivers, now here I'm going to point this out. Now, what I'm saying here in this part is hospitality is welcoming these people. But you still have to abhor evil and cling to what is good. So if this apostle is false, this teacher is deceptive, this missionary is out of sync with truth, then you can't bring them in. And here's John in 2 John. In one case, the church was keeping John out. Now John is warning the church, you keep out the deceivers. And this is where we're going with this right here. Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. Again, that's talking about the incarnation. They still talk about God. They still talk about Jesus as a great teacher. But they will not talk about him being the eternal Son of God coming in the flesh and being the returning king, or how, you know, I'd push that further if we wanted to talk about it. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Now, there's something that you might want to keep on the front burner there. The Antichrist is going to match that description. They deny Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. Again, that matches Islam. They're not denying the historical Jesus. They're denying that Jesus is the Son of God who manifests in the flesh of man to save the world. They're going to accept Jesus. Yes, he's a historical figure. But they're not going to accept the truth about Jesus. There's no power in believing Jesus was a historical figure any more than there's power in believing Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin were historical figures. The power is understanding that this Jesus is the eternal Son of God. Now, John goes on and says this, any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Verse 8, watch out that you do not lose what you have worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ, meaning you've got the Bible, but then you're going to run ahead of John's teaching. Say, well, I'm going to add some more to it. You're running ahead and not sticking with what the apostles taught. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. Verse 10 is what I'm looking for. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked work. In other words, there he's putting down. He says if some missionary, some apostle, someone comes in and they're not, they say they're a Christian, but they are not supporting this teaching, no, do not be hospitable to that trash. Send them on their way. The church is not designed to support false doctrine. Those that are in need, we're going to help. Unite with their needs. Be hospitable. When someone comes in from the church as teacher, a missionary, an apostle, support them, welcome them, and send them on their way as God would want you to. But now if someone comes in and they're not lined up with the truth, no, the church has nothing to do with them. Don't even accept them. If you do say, well, I want to be tolerant, I want to be loving, he says, you've just joined in their evil work. You cannot be tolerant of this false teaching in the church. Now again, we're going to go right to the place. Bless those who persecute you. We're not talking about hating people. We're talking about in the church. Because people are here to learn. They're here to grow. They're here to find the truth. And you bring in some charismatic teacher, someone who's got a great personality, and they start throwing down things that aren't true. It's like, what are the sheep going to do? People are not called sheep because they're fluffy. They're called sheep because they follow. That's the truth. You understand that? People follow the teaching. And you bring in a false leader, a false teacher, your hospitality has just become wicked. And it says you're joining with them. You don't have enough discernment to identify evil. Again, abhor evil. And if that evil is false teaching, be able to identify evil, separate from it, and cling to the good. And in this case, hospitality would mean sending them on their way. Okay, we'll continue this next week some more further through this. I do appreciate your time. Thank you for being here. Father, we do thank you for the word. We ask that we again may hear it, that we may understand it, that your spirit would purify it in our own thoughts, our own lives, that we'd see places to apply it, that we would be able to discern what is good and evil in our own lives and continually make good decisions throughout our days as we compare the truth to the world we live in, and we can follow the truth as revealed to us in the Scriptures and by the Spirit. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you again for being here.